BBC World Service. This is Helena Merriman with The Inquiry. This week, is opposition to genetically modified crops irrational? On Sunday the 23rd of May, hundreds of activists dressed in red streamed into the capital of Burkina Faso. Their placards and chants had one message: yes to health, no to Monsanto. They weren't the only ones protesting that day. Halfway across the world, activists in Paris were gathering too, as well as Strasbourg, Los Angeles, Santiago, and hundreds of other cities, all marching against Monsanto. As the largest producer of genetically engineered seed, it's become synonymous with GM. Ask a scientist, though, and the majority will tell you that GM food is safe to eat. The Pew Foundation released a recent poll, which found that almost 90% of scientists from America's largest science body think GM food is generally safe, while only 37% of the public agree. That's scientists 90%, the public 37%. That means that GM is now the issue on which American scientists and the general public are most divided, more so than climate change or vaccines. It's why some scientists now describe opposition to GM as irrational. And in this week's inquiry, we want to know if they're right. Is opposition to GM crops irrational?
Part 1. The science.
I spent much of my childhood in the Sierra Nevada mountains. We'd camp out in the mountains and fish in the streams. I don't think we caught too many fish, but I became very, very excited about plant biology and ultimately plant genetics.
Meet Pam Ronald, the wild child of the mountains, who's now director of the Lab for Crop Genetics Innovation at the University of California, Davis. She's won an award for her team's work in isolating the gene that makes rice tolerant to floods. It took them 10 years.
You're just amazed because you begin to wonder if that gene really exists. And today, 4 million farmers are growing flood-tolerant rice.
It's why she's so excited about genes, but equally frustrated by what she sees as a misunderstanding about genetics.
Everything we eat has been genetically improved or genetically modified in some manner. And I think what's happened over the years is that's sort of been forgotten. And there's many genetic techniques that are used.
And some of those techniques go back a long way.
8 to 10,000 years ago, our ancestors actually took corn mutants and they would cross these different mutants and to develop different types of corn varieties so they could harvest them better.
Then there's grafting, attaching the stem of one plant to the roots of another. The ancient Greeks even wrote about it, extolling the virtues of bud grafting. Verses in the Bible compared our dependence on God to that of an olive branch grafted on a tree. It was 40 years ago in California that we developed the specific skills of genetic engineering that gave us what we know as GM crops today.
That allows genes from any species to be moved into other types of organisms. So, for example, insulin was the first genetically engineered medicine that was developed, and it's been very useful because it used to be that the insulin had to be harvested from animals, but now human insulin can be produced in microbes and used for diabetics.
Scientists can now isolate a single gene from one species and insert it into another. Professor Ronald's point is this: we've been modifying our food for thousands of years. It's the methods that have changed. Where once we were just selectors of naturally occurring traits, we're now designers, which brings great benefits, she says.
The eggplant's a very important crop in Bangladesh, and there's a very serious insect, actually, that can devastate the crop. And so farmers in Bangladesh are spraying insecticides 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes even twice a day when pest pressure is very high. And in fact, in Bangladesh, they're using insecticides that are banned in the United States.
There are less toxic forms of insecticide, but these are often expensive and hard to find. That's where BT comes in. It's a gene from a soil bacterium which produces a protein that's deadly to pests.
So with genetic engineering, scientists cut the gene for BT out of the bacteria and insert it directly into the eggplant genome. It's been very successful. Last season, eggplant farmers reported they were able to reduce their chemical sprays by a huge amount, often down to zero.
It's one of the benefits of GM, she says. But is GM food safe to eat?
Okay, so let's step back a minute. So after 40 years of commercial use in medicine, cheeses, wine, and plants, and after over 20 years of careful study and rigorous peer review by thousands of independent scientists, not funded by major corporations, every major scientific organization in the world has concluded that the genetically engineered crops currently on the market are safe to eat, and that the process of genetic engineering is just as safe as older methods of genetic modification.
Of course, there are scientists who have their doubts. But Professor Ronald's point is this. There's now a broad consensus that it's safe. And if we've come to accept scientific consensus in other areas, why not GM?
These are precisely the same organizations that most of us trust when it comes to other important scientific issues, such as the safety of vaccines.
So does she think opposition to GM is irrational?
I wouldn't use the word irrational. I would say it's non-science-based.
If the science is clear, then, why are some still concerned about the risks? Is there another reason why we might distrust GM?
Part 2, the psychology.
First, I would disabuse people of proposing that we be rational about this.
This is David Ropeek. He used to be a journalist, but changed career after developing an interest in the psychology of risk.
I absolutely heard a bell ring when I discovered that our perception of risk is a combination of the facts and our feelings, and we worry too much about some and worry too little about others, and those mistakes do us harm. And yes, that was a turning point in my professional life.
He's now a consultant in risk perception who's worked with governments and companies, including GM producers. He says we're incapable of being rational when we process new information, particularly when it involves risk.
We think we're these rational, objective, post-enlightenment, we can figure everything out with science thinkers. And what cognitive science has taught us over the last 40 or 50 years is, no, we're mostly instinctive animals whose job is to survive. And that starts in the very wiring of the brain. So when information first comes into the brain, it sets off a potential fight or flight response. Our brain is hardwired to feel first and think second.
Take GM. When we look at the science, he says most of us look at it through the prism of our deeply held beliefs.
There are people who really are upset with what humans have done to nature. That's a general value. I'm one of them. You may be one of them. We're really upset about the mess we've made of the natural world. And that value then sees new technologies that can come along and interact with nature in a negative way.
So our emotional attachment to nature skews how we arrive at the facts, he says. But there's a second reason why he thinks we might be suspicious of GM. It's because genetic modifications are carried out by scientists in a lab. It's not natural.
The psychology of risk perception has found that we're more afraid in general of risks that are human-made than risks that are natural.
Why? Why is that?
The suspicion amongst the researchers is that we can blame people for doing the wrong thing, but you can't blame nature or God. And therefore, we're more upset by what is done to us by people who ought not to.
Now, some people might say we should apply a higher standard of judgment to GM for two reasons. First, that it's irreversible. And secondly, because there's still some doubt about some areas of the science, and we can't know what's going to happen in, say, 50 years' time. So it's not like other risks.
Well, that's the precautionary principle argument, and that principle holds a great deal of common sense. Goodness, lots of governments around the world are precautionary about lots of things. The extreme version of the precautionary principle says if there's any evidence at all of any harm, stop. But we have to weigh the pros and cons and what's in the greatest common good. So the what's going to happen in 50 years' time is an argument that could be used against anything. It's a generic argument to make something sound scary. But there's a whole lot of modern life that we'd have to kind of scrub out because we haven't had cell phones for 50 years either.
So is opposition to GM irrational? David Ropeik's point is that we're hardwired to be suspicious of new technology that interferes with nature. It's in our psychology. But opposition to GM isn't just about the science. There's a separate concern, not about our health, but about the impact on the lives of farmers.
Part 3. The industrial food system.
White South Africans typically have a gap year after university, and I traveled to Europe where I learned about permaculture. And I was just completely blown away learning about ecology.
Meet Heidi Swanby.
When I returned to South Africa, I started working with a lot of marginalized communities growing food. I loved having my hands in the soil. But over the decades, I've become a lot more interested in the politics of food.
In the late 90s, just after Heidi Swanby returned, South Africa introduced its first GM crop, maize, otherwise known as corn.
Right from the beginning, we were very concerned about how in control the biotech industry was in developing our legal frameworks and how close they were to our government.
Fast forward two decades, and Heidi Swanby and the NGO she works for, the African Centre for Biodiversity, now have a clear position on genetically modified organisms, or GMOs.
We would like to see GMOs banned. Our maize seed sector is owned by just two companies, which basically means that only the big boys are allowed to play, and small players are being cut out. And it's producing large volumes of very low-quality food for South Africa.
One criticism of GM is that it hooks farmers into cycles of debt. Of course, theoretically, those farmers have the choice not to plant GM seed. But if offered free seed, many of them will take it. The problem is, they then have to pay for it the next year, and the year after that.
For small-scale farmers who have very little margin for risk, it's a very dangerous technology because it's extremely expensive and it must be bought annually. And farmers need to make sure they get good prices on the markets to service their debts. And small-scale farmers don't have bargaining power. So for them to invest in an extremely top-notch, expensive technology is just very risky.
But this isn't a problem confined to GM. You get similar cycles of dependency with non-GM seeds, where farmers have to buy them yearly from the big companies. That's why Heidi Swanby says it's about changing the whole model of farming.
South Africa apart, in Africa, about 80% of seeds are still coming from the informal sector. So the vast majority of farmers are saving their own seed, they exchange seed, they sell amongst themselves, and very few are accessing hybrid seeds and conventional because it's very expensive. In Africa, the way people view seeds is they belong to everybody, they belong to the common, we share them, we exchange them. So we're facing a huge change in our social values right now, and there's a lot of resistance against that.
The debate about GM has become much more than a debate about science. As Heidi Swanby says, it's a debate about social values and the future of farming. For her, GM represents an industrial model which benefits big business, destroying the lives of poor farmers.
It's shown itself to be a very, very dangerous model. And if people have to buy their food every year and they don't have money, they starve.
But isn't that an argument for improving the model, not for ditching the technology?
It's a round peg in a square hole. You know, it's kind of like trying to boil a pot of water on a nuclear reactor instead of building a fire. It just seems to be high tech for its own sake. There's kind of a bullying force that keeps on emotionally blackmailing the world into believing that we need to adopt this technology if we're going to feed the world. But actually what it's creating is an ever bigger divide between the haves and have-nots.
For Heidi Swanby, then, GM is an unnecessary solution. But for others, it's a solution to one of the world's biggest problems, feeding a growing population. The big question is whether GM can be liberated from big business into a technology that benefits everyone.
Part 4. A new model.
When I was 9, the place got flooded.
This is Calestus Juma, our final expert witness, telling me about a defining moment in his life, a flood that devastated his village in Kenya.
There was a famine, and my father went on an expedition looking for new crops that could grow there. He came back 2-3 months later with the cassava cuttings from Uganda. Our household was the first place to introduce cassava. And we're very excited about having a new crop.
And the story could have ended there, with his father crowned a cassava hero. But this is real life, with all its unforeseen consequences.
Soon after that, there was an explosion of wild pigs. And everybody in the community accused my father to be responsible for bringing wild pigs. And so one of my earliest experiences was actually going out at night with my father, with a gun borrowed from the local priest, hunting the wild pigs.
His father didn't give up. It taught him a valuable lesson.
Whenever you hear there's a problem, it's an opportunity to be thinking about what the solution might be. And so I developed fairly early on this instinct of searching for solutions.
Calestus Juma now directs the Harvard-based Agricultural Innovation in Africa project, funded by the Gates Foundation, which supports the use of some GM crops. And he's trying to find solutions to one of our biggest problems, feeding a growing population.
In 30 years, we'll have a population of 9 billion people to feed. And that will increase the demand both for just the quantity of food, but also the diversity of food that we need. And that's why I think that we have to consider GM as one of the tools, but not the only tool that will help humanity to address those challenges.
Professor Juma doesn't see opposition to GM as irrational, but unhelpful.
I think it's unhelpful because it's driven by present-day observations, but it does not take into account long-term considerations. I strongly believe that you should be watching the problems, and as problems expand, you also expand your toolbox.
He accepts that it's often only rich farmers who can afford to buy GM seeds, but he says it doesn't have to be that way.
I don't think that genetic engineering in itself embodies a particular farming system. Yes, it is true that the way the technologies developed initially could exclude some sections of the population. But the response is not to suppress the technology. The response is to make other farmers have access to it.
One way to do that, he says, is for public institutions to develop GM, so it's not just the big corporations doing it.
By defining this as a product of large corporations, you basically end up undermining local enterprises and local researchers who have no connection whatsoever with large corporations. In fact, the bulk of the biotech research that's carried out in African countries is funded by local governments, and conducted by local researchers has very little to do with large corporations.
Take Ugandan bananas. A bacterial disease wipes out millions of dollars worth of the crop every year. So local scientists, with funding from the Gates Foundation, have been trying to develop a new variety of banana that's resistant.
This was work done by Ugandan scientists themselves on a crop that has no connection with large corporations. It's a demonstration that African scientists can move themselves to the frontiers of technological innovation and apply the same techniques to solve their own local problems. And yet, there are organizations that are fighting it because it's genetically modified.
His utopian vision of GM crops developed by local institutions has appeal, even to those like Heidi Swambi, who oppose GM.
Perhaps if it was within public institutions where there was a lot more control and transparency, it could be a useful technology, but unfortunately we see our governments just focusing on this technological solution, when actually there needs to be a much more nuanced discussion about the kind of food systems that we want to embrace.
Food systems, agricultural chemicals, farming equipment. One problem with the GM debate is that other questions and thorny issues have got stuck to it, making it hard to debate the technology on its own. It sparked such extreme passions on both sides that it's crowded out more fruitful conversations.
This whole discussion on plant genetics, I believe, is just a complete distraction from the goals of sustainable agriculture. We really need to stay focused on how farmers and rural communities can thrive. We must be sure everyone can afford the food, and we must minimize environmental degradation.
So is it irrational to oppose GM? Well, the scientific consensus says that it's safe. But as we've heard in this inquiry, the GM debate is not just about science. It's about the future of farming and food production. Until opponents of GM are persuaded not only that it's safe, but that it can benefit poor farmers as much as big business, opposition to GM will remain real and rational.
This inquiry was presented by Helena Merriman and produced in London by me, James Fletcher, and Phoebe Keane. If you enjoyed this program, you might like to listen to the inquiry asking, "Are we tired of talking about climate change?" And if you've got a burning question you'd like us to answer, demand an inquiry on Facebook or get in touch on Twitter. We're at BBC The Inquiry.